Foy Short, A Life in Southern Africa. Introduction, page 1. The popular image of a missionary is that of a man camped out in the jungle, fighting off an occasional lion and preaching to the natives in their own language. I know only one man whose experience has come even close to that, Foy Short. Thus, Sewell Hall introduced his friend, Foy Short. Foy Short's easygoing demeanor, wry smile, and dry sense of humor make it difficult to imagine him facing off with a Cape buffalo, calming a building full of frenzied worshipers going through various types of spirit-induced convulsions, or driving a group of 18 oxen with a 50-foot whip. Yet these and hundreds of other singular experiences filled his 70-plus years of preaching and teaching the Bible in Southern Africa. This will be the story about Foy Short's life and the way God used him in Southern Africa from his childhood in the 1920s to the political turmoil at the turn of the 21st century. The Restoration Movement in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. Foy Short's story in Africa begins with John Sheriff, a stonemason from New Zealand, who arrived in South Africa in 1896. Though originally linked with congregations associated with the Disciples of Christ, he was influenced to change his convictions about instrumental music and worship and form close ties with more conservative churches of Christ in the United States. After a short stay in South Africa, Sheriff settled in Bulawayo, southern Rhodesia, where he practiced his trade as a stonemason. When he saw one of his African employees reading a Bible by a campfire, he determined to teach him and others. Quote, John Sheriff soon found the opportunity to commence a night school for some African boys, meeting twice a week from 7 to 9 p.m. in his own small room. English was his subject, and the Bible was his textbook. By 1904, he had baptized 2 whites, 6 African women, and 67 African men and youth. That's from National Profiles, Republic of Zimbabwe, from the worldconvention.org. Sheriff conducted church services in a small building in his stone yard. This structure became too small, so he moved to a larger hall. By 1906, when F.L. Hadfield and his family arrived from New Zealand, there were over 200 Christians. Sheriff turned the work over to Hadfield and moved with his wife Emma a short distance out of Bulawayo to start a school for mixed-race Africans at Forest Vale Mission. Foy and his sister Sybil Dewhurst have fond memories of John Sheriff. They called him Grandpa Sheriff. Foy described him as an English-type gentleman with an English accent and a white beard and mustache. Sheriff sent out his most advanced evangelist, whom he called Mustard Seed, into other parts of southern Africa. One was George Kosa from Johannesburg, originally from Swaziland. In 1907, Kosa returned to South Africa to preach to the workers in the gold mines. One of those he baptized returned to his homeland in Bechuanaland, which is now Botswana, where he preached to his own people. In 1949, Foy Short visited Bechuanaland to help resolve some problems. He found about 1,500 Christians there who were attempting to follow New Testament principles. Another of Sheriff's mustard seed, Peter Masiya, and that's also spelled Misaya and Messiah, would be instrumental in helping Foy's father, Will Short, begin his work at Sinde in northern Rhodesia, later Zambia. In 2006, Foy Short described Masiya's work in the early 1900s in an oral report to the Bel Air, Texas Church of Christ. Quote, "When Peter Masiya returned to his home village, he announced that he would be holding a meeting and preaching under a tree outside of the village that had a lot of good shade. He invited them to hear him teach the Word of God. The first Sunday, nobody came. So he sang, read his Bible, and prayed, and returned to the village. During the following week, he talked to the people and invited them again to come the next Sunday, and nobody came. This went on for a year. Every Sunday, he would go out there, nobody would come, he would read and pray, and during the week, he would invite them again. Nobody went for a year. Finally, his mother went, and she was baptized. After that, others began to be baptized. By the time my folks went up there in 1923, there were a half dozen churches that Peter Masiya had started. That was the beginning of the work there. I don't think I would have had the tenacity to go out and preach every Sunday. When the going gets tough, don't quit." Close quotes. Another mustard seed was Jack Masiera, the Shona evangelist responsible for establishing the congregations around Wuyu, east of Salisbury, and that's now Harare. In 1903, he became dissatisfied with what he was hearing in a mission of the Church of England and began walking to seek something, though he wasn't sure what. He walked first to Salisbury, where he worked for a while, and then he began walking again. He arrived in Bulawayo and found work in John Sheriff's stone yard. He studied the Bible with Sheriff and obeyed the gospel. He returned to Mashonaland, establishing churches. John Sheriff said of Masiera, "He was one of the best preachers and elders of his people that I know of." Foy Short's father, W.N. Short, worked closely with Peter Masiya and Jack Masiera. Phases of mission work. Stanley E. Granberg divides the history of mission work of known churches of Christ in Africa into three phases. First, the mission station. Second, the institutional era. And third, the mission team era. Foy Short would live through all three eras, though he would emphasize a fourth approach that he felt to be the biblical pattern, developing autonomous congregations. Foy Short spent his childhood in the mission stations of the first era. Before World War II, the government often gave missionaries large parcels of land, or leased or sold it to them at reduced prices, with the stipulation that they be developed and that natives in the area be taught basic literacy skills. Under this type of arrangement, John Sheriff, with the help of others from New Zealand and Australia, constructed the Forest Vale Mission near Bulawayo. Foy felt that the mission stations, which at first were little more than the evangelist farms with a few extra buildings for teaching, did a good work in their initial stages. The natives could not be taught the Bible unless first taught basic literacy. Though Will Short, Dow Merritt, George Scott, and other pioneer evangelists lived on what could be called primitive mission stations, they spent much of their time traveling through the villages, establishing and then training local congregations. Foy's friend Eldred Eccles, who was credited by Granberg with initiating the institutional era, told of a revealing conversation he had with an old chief. The village leader contrasted the techniques of Foy's father, Will, and that's W.N., and other evangelists of the first era who spent much time in the villages with those of the second, who set up shop in their schools and institutions. Quote, I once sat with an old village chief who had known George Scott, Will Short, and others of the pioneer missionaries. He complained that American churches no longer sent out missionaries of the caliber of those early preachers. In particular, it was a source of grief to him that they so seldom saw us, whereas those men regularly visited all the village churches and spent much time teaching and encouraging them. I pointed out that we had to spend a great deal of our time in daily classes, educating and preparing young people to become leaders, and so we were not free to travel as they had done. I went on to suggest that we were doing a better job for the future of the church than the pioneers had done. The chief took immediate offense. Young man, he admonished me sternly, before you criticize your betters, you need to understand that those men had to farm or raise cattle to support their families, and they lived under harsher conditions than you have, and yet they still had time to do a great deal more evangelistic work than you do. They were great preachers. And then he added peevishly, I don't know what you people are, school teachers perhaps, certainly not preachers. Close quote. It didn't require a big step to transform the missions from the simple farms with classroom buildings used by evangelists into regional centers that tended to control congregations in an area. Over a period of time, there also tended to be greater emphasis on secular instruction that went beyond the basic literacy needed for reading of the Bible. Foy remembers as a young man hearing concerns expressed by contemporaries of his parents about the direction the missions were headed, with more government regulations for the schools and an ever-increasing emphasis on secular education. By 1947, when Foy returned to South Africa after several years in the States, this transformation of the primitive missions he knew as a child into denominational centers was well underway. His association with them gradually waned, especially after 1961 when his parents left the Namwianga mission to move to Bulawayo. Missions in Zimbabwe and Zambia. Number one, Forest Vale, near Bulawayo, started by John Sheriff. It was gradually enveloped by the city of Bulawayo after Sheriff's death in 1935. Dadaya, about 120 miles southeast of Bulawayo, it became a center for the Disciples of Christ denomination. Garfield Todd, a New Zealander who directed the mission in the early 1940s, became Prime Minister of Rhodesia in 1946. Sinde, in northern Rhodesia, now Zambia, about 20 miles from Livingstone and Victoria Falls. Started by Foy's father, W.N., Will Short, with the help of Peter Masiya in 1922. There is still a school there. Kabanga, also in northern Rhodesia, now Zambia, about 70 miles northeast of Sinde and east of Kalomo. Started by Dal Merritt and Ray Lawyer in 1927, before the latter's untimely death that year. W.N. Short then moved there and worked until his first trip back to the States in late 1928. Namwianga Mission, about 4 miles from Kalomo in Zambia. George Scott and W.L. Brown started building on land they bought here in 1932. It has become a center of mission work for mainstream churches of Christ. In 2008, it had a farm, a rural health center, a vocational center, 2 home-based orphan care facilities, a church development center, and schools. The schools on the Namwianga site include a basic elementary school, a secondary school, and George Benson Christian College. The college trained secondary teachers in the areas of religious education, math, and English. Norway Mission. W.L. Brown started a school here about 30 miles east of Salisbury in 1941, and it has become an educational center for mainstream churches of Christ, an outreach of the Oakland Church of Christ in Southfield, Michigan. There's also a hospital sponsored by the East Point Church of Christ in Wichita, Kansas. Wuyu Wuyu. Mistakenly called Huyuyu by John Sheriff because he was hard of hearing, and referred to as Huyuyu in most articles in the Word and Work magazine. Started by John Sheriff in the late 1920s, east of Salisbury, now Harare, fairly close, about 15 miles to what became Norway Mission. W.N. Short worked there in the early 1930s. There's still a congregation on the site that Foy, his son-in-law and daughter, David and Ellen Bays, visit when in Zimbabwe. And now a summary of some tribal terms, and we'll do the best we can with pronunciation. Amandebele, the name of the dominant tribe in southwestern Zimbabwe. The British had difficulty pronouncing this word and referred to the tribe as the Matabele or occasionally as Natabele. Total population in Zimbabwe in 2001 was estimated to be 1,500,000. Perhaps 3 million more live in South Africa. Indebele, that's an individual from the Amandebele tribe. Isindebele, that is the language of the Netabeli people, also referred to as Northern Netabeli and Sindabeli. Matabele land, that's the area in southwestern Zimbabwe settled by the Amandebele tribe. Bulawayo is the principal city. Shona, the largest tribe in Zimbabwe, about 75% of all Zimbabweans, also divided into five main clans. Most Shonas identify first with their own clans and then with the entire Shona people. Harare, originally known as Salisbury, is the principal city in Mashonaland. Mashonaland, areas in northern and eastern Zimbabwe inhabited by those of the Shona tribe. Tanga, tribe in Zambia and northwestern Zimbabwe. The Tangas predominated in areas where W.N. Short and other pioneers established the first missions in northern Rhodesia, now Zambia. Therefore, Foy Short learned their language, usually called Chitanga, as a child. Admirations and concerns from a personal perspective. Reading letters and articles about Foy's father, W.N. Short, and other pioneer workers in southern Africa, fills spiritually minded readers with admiration for their sacrificial love and dedication to God. When considering whether or not to delve into this project, I started by reading through reports in old Word and Work magazines and quickly identified with young Ray and Zelma Lawyer, the first Americans to work closely with the Shorts in southern Africa. They filled their reports with expressions of love for the Africans and optimism about future plans to teach them. Then, when I clicked on the November 1927 edition, I read Don Carlos Jane's terse message. Quote, "A very sad word is cabled from Africa that Ray Lawyer died from an accident." As I read those words in 2008, knowing nothing beforehand of what had happened, I felt the same type of shock that readers must have felt when first reading of the tragic accident more than 80 years ago. I'll admit that I shed tears as I read the story, as if he had just died. As I wept, I thought, how silly for a grown man to cry when reading this old history. Then, when reading further accounts of Lawyer's death and his wife Zelma's book and in Dal Merritt's book, I found myself wiping my eyes again, even though I'm not usually a crybaby. I had come to completely identify with the lawyers and the little band of Americans working in Southern Africa. I had come to love them, although they are all now dead. Though I came to admire the pioneer workers in Southern Africa, I groaned inwardly as I read of the gradual introduction of practices that historically have led independent Christians away from non-sectarian focus on the Master towards harmful affairs with denominational machinery. One of the behind-the-scenes heroes in the story of pioneer evangelism in Southern Africa was Don Carlos Janes, who wrote a column in the Word and Work magazine designed to promote their support. In his articles, he rejoiced and wept with the missionaries and begged and pleaded with brethren to support them. You can sense his keen anguish when godly men and women in Africa, such as W.N. Short, lost their support during the Depression. Only the Creator knows how much credit he should receive for the thousands converted through the efforts of evangelists he encouraged. And yet, Don Carlos Janes left himself open to the accusation that he was a one-man missionary society. F.B. Shrigley wrote, "No churches, so far as I know, have ever authorized Janes to take the position as a missionary director for the churches. No one appointed him to his present position, but he assumed it by degrees." Foy E. Wallace attacks Janes with characteristic gusto for being a one-man missionary society and printed a copy of his last will and testament in the Bible Banner to support his accusations. The fact that Janes was premillennial in his views probably added fuel to the fire as far as Wallace was concerned. How should primitivist Christians view obviously godly men such as Don Carlos Janes and Foy Short's predecessors, who were courageous in their sacrifices, but whose projects were sometimes precursors of an unhealthy trust in denominational structures? I think admiration is still in order for their great sacrifices, along with thanksgiving for God's mercy, even as we learn from their errors and strive to avoid them. Establishing independent, autonomous congregations. As will be seen in the main story, events on an ocean voyage to the States in late 1940 convinced Foy Short of the importance of distinguishing between the simplicity seen in first century churches that were taught by the Apostles of Jesus Christ and the complications introduced by men in human religions. He always emphasized God's grace and mercy as taught to him by his parents. However, his Bible study an association with careful evangelists in North Alabama in the middle 1940s, especially Benny Lee Fudge, also infused in him the desire to establish congregations in the mold of faithful first century churches. This implied making a distinction between that model and the human ones that tend to infiltrate God's people. Jesus and Paul emphasized evangelism simply through personal teaching. Dedicated first century evangelists established independent congregations and worked closely with them. Local congregations were the only church organizations seen among first century disciples. Efforts to introduce other ecclesiastical organizations into the mix began in the centuries after Christ with the regional bishops and dioceses. Foy Short's efforts to evangelize Africans emphasize this back-to-basic or primitivist model. He trained promising native evangelists so that they would in turn train others and establish independent congregations. He trusted that Africans could learn self-sufficiency and work to establish independence rather than dependence among them. Enemies of autonomous, independent churches. Certainly worldliness, pride, lack of love, and spiritual self-sufficiency are the greatest dangers to God's plan for his people. However, Foy Short was careful to avoid more subtle enemies to humble discipleship in southern Africa. First, institutionalism. The word institutionalism is often loaded, but will be used here to describe the tendency to see the Church of Christ as a network of congregations that has its institutions, schools, and projects. Some try to give estimates of the numbers in churches of Christ, ranging from 1,265,844 in the United States to 3 million worldwide. However, the effort to give numbers often reveals a sectarian concept of what the Church of Christ is. Biblically, the church is simply all the saved people in the world, and only God knows their number, for only he knows to whom he will extend his mercy. Disciples who are truly non-sectarian don't consider God's work to be done only by those they know. They are confident of the fact that wherever God is sought and his mercy extended, there are his people, often known only to him. Indeed, many known to be associated with various groups such as mainstream churches of Christ and others simply want to serve God and are relatively uncontaminated with the promotionalism and sectarianism that can be so distasteful to non-institutional disciples. To consider the Church of Christ to be composed solely of those influenced by our preachers and our traditions is blatantly sectarian. Institutionalism, just like all forms of sectarianism, is a danger to primitivist service of Jesus Christ, because over a period of time, it tends to redirect the disciples' focus from a person, Jesus Christ, to the traditions and institutes of the network. The questions in the minds of many becomes, what is the Church of Christ always taught on this issue, rather than, what is Christ taught? It fosters a dependence on the institutions supported by the network and erodes the non-sectarian principles that are found in the New Testament. A second enemy, dependence on American salaries. A second and even more subtle enemy of the establishment of autonomous congregations in third world countries is the unwise use of the American dollar in setting up support systems to provide salaries for native evangelists. It's subtle because there's biblical precedent for congregations supporting evangelists as they work in other areas. However, some have pointed out that strictly speaking, the biblical model, for example, Philippi's support of Paul, is for churches to support evangelists they personally know and trust and with whom they can communicate, not those they can't know well personally and whose language they can't understand. Several problems often arise when a system is set in place involving large amounts of support from American congregations to third world preachers they can never know well, usually on the basis of the recommendation of a traveling evangelist from America. A, an overdependence on outside help with a resulting lack of growth. B, misunderstandings between preachers and supporting churches when there are cultural and language barriers. C, oversupport. D, fraud, greed, and public relations manipulations. Besides the exploitation of obvious scoundrels who take advantage of American churches, even sincere men in underdeveloped countries can be tempted to get into the game of sending exaggerated reports, carefully posed photos of baptism, bombardment with email and other public relations tactics to keep the money flowing. E, the appearance of an unofficial hierarchy. At the top of the apparent system would be the American recommender, a preacher who has a number of men who depend upon his word for their daily bread and welfare can be quite powerful. Below the American recommender, sometimes there's a native recommender. Under the American recommender and sometimes the native recommender, there would be those preachers who receive American dollars. Below those who receive American dollars would be other workers. Instead of exposing sincere, humble evangelists in Zimbabwe to the sometimes overpowering temptation of American salaries, Foy Short encouraged them to earn a living making tents, while encouraging African brethren that knew them to help with their expenses and support as much as they could. Veteran African evangelists who did not see the dangers of institutionalism clearly saw the danger of American salary systems for third world evangelists. Georgia Hobby wrote, "As far as I know, there are no Zambian preachers who are supported by churches in the USA or other foreign countries. It would be easy to have a large number of preachers hired by USA churches, but much of their effectiveness would be lost because their own people would not trust their motives." Avoiding dependence on American dollars for salaries and sending benevolence to needy Christians are two different issues. The first tends to be permanent and foster dependency. The second is usually temporary, on the basis of need. Foy and Margaret Short worked diligently during the crises of the 1980s and later years to send benevolence to saints during the time of famine and political unrest. The results of Foy Short's efforts to encourage the establishment of independent, autonomous congregations in the area around Matabeleland speak for themselves. From a handful of weak congregations in the late 1940s, whose leaders did not know how to combat religious error, there are now over 100 known independent congregations in the area. Some of the congregations are very small and meet under trees, but they are generally self-sufficient in the sense of not relying on foreign support or mission centers for their evangelism and edification. Though Foy Short was by no means God's only tool for growth of these independent congregations, he was a key figure, and his efforts should serve as an example for others who are willing to do similar works. A book that summarizes Foy Short's approach to evangelism is Roland Allen's classic book, Missionary Methods, St. Paul's or Ours? A more modern article from the evangelical point of view that deals with the problem of establishing dependency with American money is Stop Sending Money, Breaking the Cycle of Missions Dependency, published in the March 1999 edition of Christianity Today. End of introduction.